the thing that many of us who have had some type of same-sex attraction, gay experiences, is this whole, like, pray the gay away. And it's like, people prayed and things shifted, but the gay didn't quite go away. It's just something else came about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's less pray the gay away. It's more like make straight the way of the Lord or something like that.
Welcome to Communion and Shalom.
In this podcast, we are exploring how the biblical and historic Christian faith can engage sexuality, ethnicity, culture, and our local communities as we pursue the flourishing of God's kingdom. Our goal is to engage these topics charitably and with nuance.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Communion Shalom. What our listeners don't know is that this is actually take two, because we lost it, the files, the first time. So thank you, Josh, for joining us, not just for one episode, but for a redo episode.
No, and what listeners also don't know is that I'm extremely glad that the first one was misplaced or lost or somehow technologically trashed, given my like weird 20 minutes of rambling. So it's good to be here with you.
Just to start us off a little bit, Josh, could you share? So in this episode, we'll be talking about kind of your own story with sexual orientation and what that's looked like over time. But can you first just, who are you? Where you're from? What kind of things are important to you in life?
Yeah, so I'm from the Midwest, from the Twin Cities area broadly. David and I have known each other for a while. And so I grew up in the church. I grew up the son of a minister. I've always been within the kind of charismatic Pentecost movement circles like that. And so, yeah, I'm still largely closeted with all but a few people. So, gosh, I think I'm going to be a weird shadow figure instead. I can't figure out how to answer that with it without giving too much away.
Yeah, that's fine. I think you like people and writing and general things like that.
I do. I like people and writing and study the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you grew up in a charismatic background, son of a minister. Can you share just about what it was like growing up in that church? And specifically, how did you think about your sexuality as you were growing up?
Yeah, I had an overwhelmingly positive church upbringing. I know that's not the universal experience, especially for, you know, people with gay or whatever you want to call. I'm not precious about terminology, but with that in their background. But for me, I did. Now, I was largely growing up during the aughts and the culture war around gayness during that time was, I don't know. It's funny, it feels like a million years ago. You talk to a Gen Zer, I think they just would have no idea what it was like to grow up in a time when the word homosexual was as or more common than gay, or when, you know, the standard position was, you know, just start talking about how unnatural it is, unprompted for like 8 minutes. But it also didn't bother me because I was dedicated to the evangelical culture war as anyone. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think I had a church body that, despite the fact that I was fully closeted, no one knew, or actually I'm sure plenty knew. Nobody had received confirmation, but I never got the sense that anyone was interested in condemning me for attitude. Mm. And I think that people had a really good sense of the fact that your relationship to God is not somehow in like outgrowth of your sexual activity or desires. And so in that way, I think it was actually a very great place to be anchored, even if it was, you know, lonely.
Mm. When were you first aware of your own proclivity towards the same sex rather than the opposite sex?
Probably years after everyone else, since I was the gayest little boy you've ever met in your life. But I don't know, probably 11 or 12 or something like that. It became clear what was and was not coming online and that there was a strong preference for men. I think I framed it to you this way before. Basically, exclusively sexually attracted to men, or almost, but exclusively emotionally or romantically attracted to women. And that was pretty stable from a pretty young age, and I'd say the sexual part really came online in full force, you know, like a preteen.
Hmm. Did you date at all in high school or around there?
High school, no. College through, you know, mid-20s.
Sorry, and to be, I guess...
Only women.
Yeah, dating women. But the romantic attraction.
Right, yeah. I've never dated a man, but, you know, at some point you realize that it's a deeply unkind thing to keep dating women as a closeted homosexual and just let them feel angry and confused and hurt and gaslit or heartbroken. Mm. And so eventually I stopped and just kind of decided that, not to be dating anymore.
Mm.
But for a few years there was, that was the thing.
And when you stopped dating, was that a kind of, I have now decided to give the rest of my life to celibacy, or just right now with where things are at, that doesn't seem to be a kind thing?
I mean, when I was young and at first, you know, kind of came online and I figured out what my attraction was, my feeling was that I always held that hope for healing, and I didn't exactly know what that would necessarily look like. And I also didn't have an expectation, a heavy expectation in either direction that it would or wouldn't happen. I grew up in a tradition that believed in healing, but frankly, it wasn't something especially visible or common. It was something that, you know, you would pray for healing if somebody got sick or whatever, and you heard stories of when it would happen. But it was not a situation like the community I'm in now, where it's a fairly common experience to see or experience that as a kind of normal part of Christian life. And so for me, I always held out hope that things would change. I knew that if he did heal me, then wow, God is good. And if he didn't heal me, then wow, God is still good. But so when I was, you know, in my 20s and eventually just kind of gave up dating, he asked celibacy if he doesn't heal, although I'll admit the kind of expectation that would come at some point had would dwindle over the years.
And how, you said, you know, that you're still mostly closeted. Did, as you were, I guess, coming to terms with like, okay, I'm not gonna be able to pass straight right now, and I'm going to stop dating, passing straight in the way of like, get a girlfriend, get a wife, have kids, and people will stop wondering. Did you have people that were in on kind of the intimacies of your life, or was this, just like a lot of people who remain like hyper closeted, a lot of shame is very typical.
Yeah, no, it's, I didn't tell. I'm about 30 now. I didn't tell anybody until under a year ago. And so, yeah, quite a bit of shame. But I think that a lot of people assume that if you're gay or queer or whatever you want to use and closeted, that you feel shame as an expression of, as a function of your kind of puritanical religious beliefs. And it has constantly been the case that I've found, as somebody who did not pass especially well over the years, I've become much more straight passing. But as somebody who did not, I've always found non-Christians to be far more unkind about it when making a comment about it than Christians. I think for me, it was largely not an issue of shame, as in guilt over having a non-standard or gay sexual attraction. It was never shame before God. It was the kind of weird social shame that accumulates within the church, outside the church, but as a function of just kind of the humiliation of everybody knowing anyway, the kind of like that silly dance you do when it's like obvious, but you still have to say the thing. And then also, you know, there's, as you get older, you realize oh, I can't just like forever pretend to be a millennial who thinks that marriage is dumb without people like really scrutinizing that at some point. and so there's an indignity to that when the jig continues to be up.
Is that what spurred you starting to share with friends or?
No. What spurred it was, well, I don't want to have people be uncomfortable with this framing, but the healing experience that I've mentioned to you before, I didn't tell a single person, you know, like I'm gay until I kind of wasn't anymore, but kind of was. I don't know.
That's really funny. So, okay, tell us some more. So you already mentioned that, okay, you're for maybe a couple of years now, you are now part of a church where healing experiences are more common. Can you kind of start with your introduction to this church, what kind of that culture looks like, and what led up to your own experience of healing and change in your sexual orientation?
Yeah, I felt really spiritually dry for a long time. And one of the things that complicated my relationship to church, I hadn't attended church faithfully for a while. I had one I kind of sometimes attended, but like actually I still have a lot of affection for that church. But I also had pretty intense OCD that made church attendance pretty tough because it was triggered in particular by social anxiety. But then also the way it manifested was everybody in my life thought, partially because, you know, I lied to them and told them this, but that I had Tourette's because I would compulsively shout, you know, especially about half the time it was just loud noises, about half the time it was profanity. So specifically, it's uncomfortable to sit in a pew and just have like hold in your desire to like shout out filthy epithets. But eventually you just get like so spiritually sick that it's kind of like worth I don't know, like the nauseating feeling of having to go into a church building and do that. I accidentally read a Christian book. I was told it was a good book called Something They Will Not Forget by Joshua Gibbs. And I thought it had to do with classical education, and it turned out to be about Christian classical education. And he had a few really good lines in there, but one of the ones that grabbed me the most was, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have it memorized, but he's written a test that the students have to take, but he's narrating their future lives in like 10 or 20 years. And so there's this long prologue as to what their life is before they actually have to respond. And in it, it says, you don't really like the church you attend, but you decide to keep going anyway. You realize that God did not make the world to please you. Rather, he made you to please himself. And so you decide to keep going to church, even though you don't like the hymns they sing. And it just, like, it hit, you know, whatever your version of the hymns they sing is, sorry, he didn't make the world to please you. He made it to please himself. And so that was enough to get me in the door. And then once I was in the door, an experience, I don't know, a month, maybe a month and a half, in which people laid hands on me and I was healed of that OCD. It used to be hundreds of times on a good day, thousands of times on a bad day. You know, at times just shouting in my room over and over this profanity, just trying to make, you know, quiet down the racket in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all based around shame for me. My obsessions were shame-based, and it was shame, embarrassment, regret, worry about the future. But it was all anchored in some version of that. And Jesus took it. And that kind of ambient knowledge of healing and grace and has been something that's like available, but largely in kind of an abstract sense, or something that you assume happens in Argentina or in Zimbabwe and like doesn't happen in the West, or like it's the aberration, not the expectation. And then once that became a part of your life and you meet Jesus, the healer, it's hard to ever again have an experience of thinking that that's not central to his character. And I think that was that kind of turning point that brought me back to the place of, okay, let's pray on this other thing too. this, you know, gay thing that you've kind of put on a shelf in your mind for a while. So it was quite a while later that I brought that back to mind, and it wasn't the only focus or even the main focus of my prayers, but I had a pretty like intense prayer with, you know, a conversation with God asking him to move. And a couple of weeks later, I went to a men's retreat, and I promise, despite the phrase men's retreat, we were not just talking about how, you know, sad we are that we all like look at porn and masturbate or something. It wasn't about sex fundamentally. It was just, this just happened to be a tangential part of the story. But there was a night where people were praying for each other, and the pastor then says, whoever you're praying for right now, I feel like we're just supposed to pray for physical healing. And at that point, somebody who's praying for me leans in and he says, I feel like I've got a word. I feel like God is just saying, blood flow. Blood flow where it needs to go. And I just start laughing, realizing that God has just made a dick joke through this, you know, wonderful brother in Christ, and that this penile euphemism, I'm the only one in the room who understands. And it's not as though you, like, can... There's no immediate way to test this out, right? But within...
There wasn't any other loss of blood in any other parts of your body, a pinky toe with poor circulation.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But I'm at a men's retreat, right? There are no women there, so it's not as though there's, like, you know, we don't have... You only have the control group. But within, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, it became clear that I was attracted to women for the first time.
Hmm.
And that didn't mean I wasn't also attracted to men or that it was identical, but there was like an undeniable and dramatic change.
Hmm. Hmm. And you said that the experience of kind of more of the romantic attraction towards women, that's always been there. And is that still kind of been a constant, or did that also change in the midst of this?
No, it's unchanged in that way. The sexual attraction is now there. The romantic attraction is still there. I'm back to dating women.
And how would, just really quick, could you give just a little bit of a description? Because romance means a lot of different things in different cultures. What does romantic attraction mean for you?
Oh.
It's a hard one.
Yeah. I feel like I should have like some poetry book by someone else. What is love? The idea of, this will sound dumb, the idea of like kissing or cuddling with a man is just so dramatically unappealing and always has been, because that's an emotional attachment that you're forming to a man. But there are girls that you just fall for, right? You can't stop thinking about them. You want to text them, you want to hang out with them, you get like, I don't know, like a weird pang of jealousy every once in a while. Like all that exclusively there for women, and yeah,
right.
Just not there for men.
And so now, not only romantic attraction for women, but also sexual attraction, and you're dating someone now?
Yeah, I am. It's newish.
Well, you don't have to give us all the juicy details.
Exactly. I was about to say this would be quite the way for us to have a conversation, which we're like going to have soon, but haven't. No, it's going well.
I always like the old phrase, are you going steady?
we're going steady.
So back when we recorded initially, we were kind of talking about how it's like there's these two buckets of attraction. There was the attraction to the same sex and attraction to the opposite sex. And the opposite sex attraction to women was an empty bucket. And the male one was pretty full. And then after this experience, a few weeks later, by the time we were interviewing, it was something like, you know, one's pretty full and the other one's like maybe halfway full. But has that continued to be the case, or... As things go, has there continued to be change in how you proportion out or compare these attractions?
Yeah, the buckets metaphor is a good one. There was the two-thirds full women's bucket, and then there the still obnoxiously full men bucket. And over time, because it's been over a year at this point. I don't know. There was something around the 1 year mark where things like felt like there was another kind of shift, and it's a little hard to describe whether there's like exact parity now, although whether or not it's exact, it's close. I mean, that's the thing about men and women. And I mean, the historical Christian perspective is that men and women are non-identical, non-symmetrical, but like equal in value and worth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how other people would feel or describe it. I've pretty consciously absented myself from most gay discourse, but for, I don't know, the things that are attractive about a man or a woman are different. And so it's a little hard to like compare.
Yeah.
To use like a contextually gross metaphor, apples to oranges. So yeah, I don't know.
I think a lot of people with bisexual experiences, if we can put it under that umbrella, would resonate with what you're saying. It's not just because you have attractions to both doesn't mean that they're the same exact same attractions, or that they work in the exactly the same way.
Yeah. But I would, I mean, functionally at parity at this point, and the experiential bit of it's weirdly different making out with a woman as a closeted homosexual and then doing it as somebody who's actually attracted to a woman, weirdly enough. There's something different that, I don't know. It's just the life experience, I think, has amplified things.
Hmm. You know, it's really interesting hearing your story. So you mentioned the episode that we recorded with Marco, where his emphasis on healing, he talks about in the context more of like reintegration, and it's very therapeutic, psychoanalytical. And your story doesn't really have any of that.
No, a decidedly unwise level of avoidance of that. Yeah, no, although I'll justify it a little with, given the number of like gay conversion bans and things, it is quite hard for a Christian in a position like mine to find somebody who's willing to advertise themselves as somebody who's open to discussing a biblical sexual ethic with somebody in a position like mine. But no, not a whole lot of therapy outside of the just like telling your friend and them going like, no way, that's awesome. Like, that's, you know, that you know, my friends, they're idiots. So it's yeah.
Lovely friends.
Yeah. They're great.
And another, I mean, so there's, it doesn't fit a lot of those like psychedelic therapies, though it does fit in part the thing that many of us who have had some type of same-sex attraction, gay experiences, it is that this whole like pray the gay away. And it's like people prayed and things shifted, but the gay didn't quite go away. It's just something else came about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's less pray the gay away. It's more like make straight the way of the Lord or something like that. But yeah, there are a whole lot of Christians who are bothered by, allergic to, and made uncomfortable by the idea of prayer being effective in this area of life. Some for thoughtful reasons, I'm sure. But that's one of those other things that make it more convenient to come out to just a handful of people and leave it there.
Hmm. You know, we talked that from when we recorded the first time, and now there's already, you know, just some increasing maybe experiences of the opposite sex attraction, of being attracted to women. And so it's just like, you're still in the middle of your story. You know, like this is both where you're at in your story right now. This is how you think about your story right now. Where do you have any inclination or hopes of where your story will continue to go, specifically around sexuality and the implications of that in your life?
Yeah, I for a long time had just kind of reconciled myself to the likelihood that really the only kind of Christian way forward was, you know, celibacy. And I just kind of made peace with the idea that, like, kids are for other people, marriage is for other people. You'll have to, you know, find some dignified cover at some point. But, I mean, I guess I do find myself drawn towards a traditional, you know, find a woman, do the whole thing. So, yeah, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but...
I guess that's a somewhat obvious answer to, like, your dating. And so the hopes of that, because, you know, when we spoke last time, I was like, well, if God, Lord, still called you towards celibacy, this would be a, feel like a somewhat cruel healing experience.
Although Marcos would, it sounds like, disagree, right? The idea that, and this isn't my perspective, but with that idea that to choose celibacy as, or at least within the Catholic tradition, as an act of doing, you know, being a celibate for the kingdom of God, the idea that actually kind of has to come with a full recognition of the goodness of marriage and children as something desirable. That is not where I am, and it's not my theology either, but I could see a world in which this turned out that way for someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I was thinking about that and hearing other people's thoughts on it, at first I was like, oh, I see the beauty in that, and I don't think it's good if someone chooses celibacy out of a hatred of marriage. But I was thinking about there's so many other vocations that the Lord calls us into where, you know, it's like someone doesn't have to fully, I don't know if this is but I think there's just many situations where just because you can see the goodness of it doesn't mean that you have to see it as possible for you.
Right. And I'm still with you. I think it's really easy to lose sight of the fact that God is really kind, and that when he calls us to sacrifice, it's not for the purpose of it hurting or for the purpose of us feeling loss, like that will happen. And there's something to counting it as a loss. But I think that might be, I'm sure I don't mean to like misrepresent his perspective on it. I'm sure he wouldn't suggest that God is trying to be punitive in that way. But to me, there's something, I don't think that when God asks us to give up good things, there are plenty of good things that we're asked to give up for good reasons other than their goodness, making us, I don't know, somehow more complete in our sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, as you are pursuing marriage, you are giving up the good thing of singleness. And I appreciate that I think you recognize that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no one it's not as though I haven't done the single thing for a while, and there are for sure trade-offs, right? I mean, I prefer the current thing, but
mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I think for gay Christians or same-sex attracted Christians, you know, whatever the thing is that make people comfortable, but I think within the church in particular, although I don't have a ton of... I'm not interested in issuing a ton of gripes with the church, but I think one of the ways we could be more effective and generous towards our gay brothers and sisters is to figure out a way to make singleness something that is honored and sustainable. And Paul's like, I don't know, exhortation for everyone to check out celibacy and see how good it is for themselves and for Jesus, I think that's not to be taken lightly, and it's difficult because it's a social commitment to an individual disposition, right? If we were to make that something that is, I don't know, kind to single brothers and sisters in that way.
Mm. So you've had this experience of healing at your church, which I know some people who are afraid of stories like these being weaponized against those potentially, you know, called to singleness. And yeah, how is that conversation looking in your church, or are there things that you're thinking about how you will handle that and hold that in community in a way to both really recognize the type of healing work that God can do in our lives while still recognizing the different vocational paths and the different needs that both of those carry.
Yeah, I think I'm in the enviable position of being both closeted and ignorant of most of the discourse. So I've been able to dodge it by virtue of not knowing about it or being visible. If that were ever to change, I'm pretty hands off and not about to tell anybody you have to belong to this camp or that camp as it comes to pursuing Christ in a biblical within a biblical ethic. I mean, you've referenced to yourself as like kind of jokingly side bikes, right? You see some benefit to side B, side Y, and side X, all terms I did not know until I listened to your podcast. But I guess that's roughly where I am, where like I don't know that the like weird God made me bisexual narrative neatly fits into any of the side bikes camps. And so, I mean, I used to attend a church that it wasn't certainly like the main topic of, you know, most sermons or anything, but there were a number of side X folks there, people who would say, I am same sex attracted and I am part of this ministry where I don't know how to describe it exactly, but we do things in community that are designed to, yes, honor God, but then also to kind of nudge our sexual orientation back into the way, back into a straighter place.
Hmm.
That always made me feel deeply uncomfortable as just like a personal thing. I never considered joining anything like that, but I'm certainly not about to shame anybody who is faithfully pursuing God, not sinning as they do. So I think I might encourage them to like, fix their eyes on Jesus and this aspect of him or that aspect of him the way I would any friend who was like rigorously pursuing something in a way that like that was unusual or didn't square with my expectations. But I'm not going to tell somebody who's side B or side Y or side X or something else who's doing their best to follow Jesus given this weird hand they've been dealt. I guess I'm not prescriptive.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that the one prescription I would have would be I'm saddened if I hear somebody kind of fully write out the possibility of healing from their story or theology or worldview. I think we do that in a lot of areas, not just gayness, which is to the detriment of both the person who's missing out on the healing, but then also of a body that I think sees a less full picture of Jesus. If when we see like the giants in the land, we turn around and run.
Mm. Whenever I think about healing and that kind of work of ministry on this side of heaven, I'm reminded of this African preacher, healer man who, you know, like thousands of people are coming to his rallies. Many people are getting healed, you know, legs being extended, all the fun things. And he himself was in a wheelchair and other people are like leaving their wheelchairs there at the, you know, like,
yeah.
And it, just some of this mystery, I like mystery of this is a man who deeply believes in the healing power of God, is witnessing it very regularly and has this part of his life for whatever intent of God's, you know, that is not healed, even though he knows God could. And I've not heard him like speak on this at all, but just the general details of his story. I find just witness to that, like, how do we continue to just keep our eyes on Jesus the healer without, in a sense, put our eyes on the healing, you know, like don't get so fixated on this specific gift, but just keep our eyes on Jesus, knowing that he's good.
Which, like, Paul is clear, first century Christians, like, from the beginning, that's such a huge temptation. the focus on the creation, not the creator, or the gift, not the giver. No, I'm fully with you, and I think it gets tough with healing, because I think it kind of requires you to go to like a weirdly philosophical place with it right away. If you ask a question about the practical thing that's going around to answer the question of like, is God why that person isn't healed? I have to run myself through this, like, I guess I do. I think that from him and to him and through him are all things, and he made all things good. And so maybe we have to follow Augustine and say the privation theory. Like maybe it's the case that the unhealed thing is really like evil in absence, right? Evil is twisting. Evil is deviation. So maybe it is the case that Jesus always heals, and maybe we just haven't seen it in this case. Like it's a tough one, because unlike other areas of how you lead your life as a Christian, like walk with integrity or honesty or to the poor or any of these others, it never feels disconfirmed if you do it and don't see the thing you expected, right? Like we've all had the experience of giving generously or something, and then like, oh, they didn't say thank you or use it well. That never hits us as proof that we weren't actually, or that there are some circumstances in which giving generously is either worthless or not intended. It's not a perfect comparison, but healing does something different for us. It makes us like we look to the result, and we question our expectation of whether or not this should be a full or a regular part of the Christian life. And I wouldn't take it off the table that there are instances in which it isn't his will. But frankly, I think Jesus heals. Like, I just think that if Jesus were here and someone had a malady, he would heal them. And I can't speak to the situation of the African man in the wheelchair, but I think Jesus would heal him. And I guess that's kind of the expectation I carry around now, even though it's not always the case that when I pray for healing, it happens. I will say now, sometimes it does. And that was not true before. I became convinced that Jesus is just the guy who goes around healing people.
I'm not caught up with The Chosen, but, you know, even just in the gospel stories of, you know, coming to that one strange pool where people jump in or whatnot. And of like, he heals one person there. So like he does heal, like he goes around and he heals people. And there are times where it's just like people are lining up to get healed. And there's other times he goes out and he heals one person. So, and in my own experiences of healing often being partial healings, where it's like, that was miraculous, but it felt like it wasn't the full miracle that I would want for me to feel like things fit in my box.
Every time for me too. Always been either as the recipient or the prayer. It has always been partial healing. Although miraculous, but partial. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah, and that, I don't know if God just does that so that, you know, to encourage faith even in the midst of like something that's a big faith encourager. And talking with TJ, and we were just thinking about, I want to have more conversations, you know, with folks who experience different types of disabilities. And there's certain disabilities that, you know, he has he sees a lot of healings in Africa as well, that he's never seen something that we would put in just the big box of disability as something that gets healed, something like Down syndrome. And where does disability overlap with neuro and experiential diversity and like other interesting purposes that God has for us in those things, even they do bring weakness and privations in our life, that there's sometimes unique goods that can come about through that. So unanswered Those are just my open queries right now. Do you plan on having, I mean, I don't know how you do this without being a little bit more out, but any more direct relations to people in the LGBTQ community? I mean, you can be a friend to any, you know, gay unbelieving neighbor, but in a way that you can say I relate to you?
No, I mean, as a side note, I just don't even believe there is an LGBTQ community. there are like these are not people with either, like, they don't have shared interests. They don't even share each other's company half the time. Like, the reason you build lesbian bars so you don't have to hang out with the gays. There are no lesbians anymore. All the lesbians I used to know are, with the exception of one, are all either trans or non-binary. Like, these are people with, like, directly opposing interests in many cases. And so I think, like, the visible idea of an LGBTQ community is, like, a really convenient thing. If like, you aren't good at, like, cobbling together optics, or if you're, like, a bunch of young people living in the city, in which case, yes, like, queer people do, like, find each other, like, moths to a flame. But it's, like, a certain kind of queer person, right? The same way that, like, theater kids are always going to hang out with theater kids. And so, like, I don't know. I kind of a little bit just reject the category of an LGBTQ community, because the only ones who refer to themselves as a community are the ones who aren't hanging out with the ones who aren't in it. But that's a little bit beside the point. I have always, you know, moth to porch light style. As a young person, just felt like, you know, everybody I knew was a lesbian. I was always hanging out with lesbians, always hanging out with queer folk. Over time, that has changed some, although it did end up, you know, when I was in academia, I was in a department that was, I think by the time I was gone, like, mostly gay. So like, I traveled in those circles a ton, but I guess I don't feel any specific need to. If a queer person is at a theological crossroads, if they are my brother or sister in Christ, now I feel like the gay conversation becomes productive, or sharing my own experience becomes productive or helpful, and something that's not just inflaming or contrarian. If this is somebody who is not a Christian, well, I don't think this is a, like, my story of weird, I turned from gay to bi thing. I don't think it's going to be well received, and I also don't think it's going to be helpful. I think to the extent that kindred spirits find each other and can show Christian love, that's the way in which I can be of effect. I may change my mind on that, but that's kind of where I am now.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I love. You know, it's just, this is how you're thinking about it now. And while podcast listeners may not get a chance to hear how you're thinking about this in another year, I will. I think I would.
And I'm going to ask that you never make me re-listen to this. Once I change my mind and I hate every episode.
Don't worry. Lord willing, we will not be doing a third recording either. If you're familiar at all with arguments for the side A progressive theology, have any of those ever been persuasive to you?
No, they haven't. You know, I learned Greek and Hebrew and a handful of others, partly so that I could dive into questions like that. And, you know, it's been a while, so don't test me. But, like, when I did some, I don't know, more detailed study of some of the, like, key texts, and I'll admit that this is coming from a place of valuing text over other methods of discovering and talking about God. You know, kind of a prima scriptura, a way of thinking about things. But I think it is hard to persuade I think a lot of people don't realize how unkind it is. On the basis of trying to be a good ally, trying to be generous, trying to be helpful to gay people, to gaslight them into believing that they are the ones who are reading the scripture to mean exactly the opposite of what it says.
Mm.
And you kind of have to do that in order to read Paul in any, it does not feel coherent or in most cases good faith. Although I do know some good faith people who generally believe it and will generally argue it for it. But we all fall prey to motivated reasoning. And I've never heard an argument that took the scriptural part seriously that didn't feel like kind of a wish list of what Paul had said instead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What's your experience been there?
Yeah, the motivated reasoning is it's a hard thing to suss through, right? Because then you're trying to be objective, but you're like, would love for it to say one thing, but on the other hand, you know, that set you apart from your community. And so we have different biases pulling us different ways.
For sure.
But I think similarly, I first started trying to like learn a little bit of Greek and trying to answer these questions of, oh, what are some of the arguments that people are making? And especially some of the old ones simply being like, oh, what it should be translated as pederasty. And it's like that word pederasty is coming from a Greek word that's more or less pederasty. Like they had a word for that. There's just so many. And it's like some of the arguments have evolved and improved, but seeing that they've like largely come out of communities that used to believe the old ones and they've just been improving theirs, like they weren't waiting until, you know, they just, yeah. And yeah, I think there are ones that are more worth engaging and others that are less worth engaging. And we've tried to talk to some of those authors some of the Side A guests who have taken less of the just like, what did Paul mean or what did Leviticus mean? And they're doing larger hermeneutic things that kind of sidestep asking that direct question.
And I'm actually more receptive to that than I think a lot of people would expect, or at least receptive to like hearing that out as
mm-hmm.
a valid line of inquiry.
I mean, in some ways, I feel like it's the only... There, Matthew Vines, I believe, still does try to make the direct textual argument and say, this is how we should understand that Paul is talking about something very different. My response now that I'm actually working on with that, not like writing an essay, but just thinking about, is that when they say, oh, the way that people thought about gay relationships back then, they couldn't even conceive of our committed monogamous gay relationships today.
I think Andrew Sullivan will say the same in his columns. Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I think that actually applies to the way they thought of heterosexual relationships too, though. Like the way that they experienced heterosexual relationships, they couldn't even imagine the type of like egalitarian, non-dominating, like free romantic choice rather than like family obligations. And so like you did disregard all the scriptures on marriage because it's very different from how we think about power dynamics and importance of romance today. Like there are so many differences and it's not just with gay marriages. So it's kind of I feel like misleading. It's like, you're right. But yeah, I don't think it gets you where you want to go.
Right. That's such a good point that it has to cut both ways. The argument of cultural gap, right? Like, so
yeah.
What do you do with...
Because it's like most guys would have married much younger women.
Right.
And so like we have a pretty strong feelings about that not happening today. Like a 28-year-old man marrying a 16-year-old girl would have been acceptable back then. And... It's if you get parental permission, you might be able to make it legal, but we'd be like, we would all look at that a little bit odd today.
100%.
And yeah, so just the norms and expectations around marriage. Yeah, just so many differences. We can even parse through all of them. I really love the episode that we did with Catherine, where she just gives a history of romance in the West. And she doesn't get into some of those dynamics, but just starts helping you see, like, whoa, the way we think about romance and marriage is just so different than today. You really have to rely on, yeah, a lot of, like, biblical and Christian tradition and thought to say, what is marriage essentially? What is sex essentially? And I think it works way better to try to answer those questions first and understand what are their purposes, and then say, do these things align with those purposes? And that's where a lot of kind of side B folks have said, even if none of the quote unquote clobber passages existed, I would still have a traditional sexual ethic because of the bigger picture, the story behind what God is doing with man and woman, what the purpose is quite naturally, like, visible for what the genitals are for, that all of this kind of goes together, how child rearing works into that, that picture is attractive and beautiful and trustworthy. And I don't need these passages that say, no, don't do that, to see how homosexual sex and thus homosexual marriages deviates from that picture. So I found that very compelling.
Well, and that's a great point, because it, I think, probably also separates out the different Protestant groups. You know, Catholics, like, the idea of natural law is, like, pretty firmly cemented in a ton of that, their theology, even beyond sexual ethics stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Protestants, it's more hit or miss whether or not that's something that, like, a congregant will even have heard before.
Yeah.
And I think that may be one of the reasons why, like, intuitions around this are so everywhere in different denominations.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I'll have friends who are, like, I don't know, of similar theological disposition in, you know, X, Y, or Z area, and then it weirdly all falls apart. Normally, right at where the, like, natural law stuff kind of has to take the driver's seat. And I think that is a place where we could grow and learn from our Catholic brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. And I think it very much is parallel to what has often been described as kind of skipping over Genesis 1 and 2, and a lot of Protestant theology more recently starting at Genesis 3, of like, oh, things got bad, and so we need a savior. And it's like, God is creator first and foremost, and we need to understand that good creation, and that's part of our ongoing work as humans, as his representatives in this world. And so I think it that lack of natural theology pairs with that kind of forgetting the creation story fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. No, that's good.
Well, thanks so much, Josh, for sharing your story. And I hope it both provokes myself and listeners both to just, ultimately to just continue to reflect upon who Jesus is, ask questions around sexuality, and be thinking about how we continue to be loving those, our brothers and sisters in the church, well, who are in different experiences and journeys and such. But doing all of this in a way that continues to just keep Christ center. So thanks for being a testimony to that.
Thanks for having me. And I'll be happy to talk to you again when I'm straight and that African guy's out of the wheelchair 6 months from now.
great. Okay, bye. Hey, listeners, I want to let you know about the Communion and Shalom Patreon. Joining the Patreon community not only supports this podcast, but gives you the opportunity to listen to bonus content, give input on future episodes, and submit questions for a patron-only Q&A. We're so thankful for the support and encouragement from so many listeners, and we hope that this podcast continues to be meaningful to you.